last I was overcome with a desire to mount the seven steps and see the seven punishments, and was suitable in a single day. So I went back in order to complete the ascent. I lost my way, discouraged, and I fell asleep. And while asleep, I saw a barber clad in royal purple who stood outside the place of punishment. And he said, "Man, what are you doing here?" And I said, "I lost my way." And he said, "Follow me." And I saw him enter the place of punishment, and his whole body was consumed by the fire. On seeing this, I stopped, trembling with fear, and I awoke and said within myself, "This is the brazen man, the barber, the man in purple, and it is needful that he must first enter the place of punishment." Again my soul desired to mount the third step, and I again followed the path alone, and went astray. Then saw the old man, whitened by the years, and I asked him to show me the way, and he looked, stared at me for an hour, and then he hastened on his way. I scourged around, lost, but finally found the altar and stood at top. And I saw him transferred into a pillar of fire, his eyes full of blood because of the terrible punishment. And I asked him why he was stretched out like that, and he groaned and said, "I am a leaden man, and I submit myself to unendurable torment." He with great fear I woke up, sought within myself the reason, and then understood that the lead must be rejected. And in truth, the vision refers to the composition of the liquid. And again I beheld the divine and holy altar, and I saw a priest clothed in a white robe, celebrating those terrible mysteries. And I asked, "Who is this?" And the answer came, "This is the priest of the inner sanctuary. It is he who changes the bodies into blood, and makes the eyes clairvoyant, and raises the dead." And then I fell asleep. As I was ascending the fourth step, I saw to the east a priest approaching with a sword in his hand, and another behind him clad in white, adorned with symbols. His name was Meridian of the Sun. As they drew nearer to the place of punishment, he who held the sword said, "Cut off his head, cut up the body into pieces, and let it be boiled according to the method of punishment." And I awoke and said, "I understand, this concerns the liquid in the art of the metal." And he who bore the sword said, "You have completed the descent of the seven steps." And the other answered, as he caused the waters to gush forth from all the moist places, "The procedure is complete. In short, my friend, build a temple from a single stone, like unto white lead, to alabaster, to marble, with neither end nor beginning in its construction. Let it have within it a spring of sparkling water, pure as the sun. Note carefully on what side is the entrance to the temple, and take a sword in your hand. Seek the entrance, for narrow is the place where the opening is. The dragon lies at the entrance. Stand in the pot, step on pieces, and enter it. You will find what you seek. The priest, the brazen man seated in the spring, has changed the color of his nature and become the silver man, and soon the golden man." After I had seen that apparition, I awoke and said to myself, "What is the cause of that vision? Is not the boiling water, white and yellow, the divine water?" And I understood, and I said, "Beautiful it is to speak, and beautiful to hear. Beautiful to give, and beautiful to receive. Beautiful to be poor, and beautiful to be rich. How does nature teach giving and receiving? The metal gives, and the plant receives. The stars give, and the flowers receive. The heavens give, and the earth receives. All things are woven together, and all things are undone. All things flourish and fade in the bowl of the altar. Each thing comes to pass with method, and fixed measure, and by exact weighing of the four elements. The weaving together of all things, and the undoing of all things, cannot come together without method. To sum up to the harmony of separating and combining, and if nothing is neglected, all things bring forth nature. For nature, applied to nature, transforms nature. Such is the order of natural law throughout the whole cosmos, and all things hang together." I thought about that law, so I would. didn't understand too much of it, just a bit of it. And one night I was thinking of this, and I felt very, very sad. I realized that Bell Smith was a very wise man, but I thought of all the hundreds of thousands of souls that had tried to find that freedom, to find those steps, and had been caught in the chaos, and lived out their lives in mental institutions. And I guess I was a little disappointed, because I thought there had to be a newer way, a safer way, a more loving way for man to be free. Then I thought, the old crumb, quit weeping, go to the end of the chapter, see if it has a happy ending. And so I did. And the end of the chapter is the origin of the vision. Since alchemy is concerned with mysteries, both physical and spiritual, it need come as no surprise that the composition of the waters was revealed to Zalcinus in the dream. His sleep was the incubation, his dream sent by God. The divine water was the Alpha and the Omega, and the process desperately sought by the alchemists was the goal of their desire. The dream, therefore, came as a dramatic explanation of the nature of this water. The dramatization came forth in powerful imagery, the violent process of transformation. The drama showed the divine process of change, the cycle of the death and rebirth of the gods. The mystical side of alchemy, as distinct from its historical aspect, is essentially a psychological problem. The causes that set forth such a process in motion may be certain pathological states, and such a process in motion, which produces similar symbols. The best and clearest material comes from people of sound mind, who, driven by kind of spiritual distress, of spiritual or religious, philosophical or psychological reasons, changing times have changed the process. The following text serves to illustrate the ancient point of view. As Christ said in Luke, the light of the body is in the eye. The kingdom of God is within you. The light of man must emerge from within. The spoken word is only to be heeded as a guide. Also hidden in man is a divine light, and it cannot be placed in man, but must emerge from within. Zalcinus and others of his like mind were looking for the divine body or mystic body, conceived to be a gift of the Holy Spirit, or gift of grace conferring redemption. Man's longing for redemption is universal. No serious question about hope. Although chemistry has nothing to learn from the vision of Zalcinus, it is a mine of discovery for modern psychology. I think that was good for us.
I took the part on the sacrificial act in the vision, and these are Jung's interpretations, or some of Jung's interpretation of what the sacrificial act is all about. The central theme of Zosimus's dream is the sacrificial act for alchemical transformation, and in his vision, the priest is at once both the sacrificer and the sacrifice. According to Jung, the vision illustrates that Zosimus was very familiar with Hebrew and Christian teachings, for Christ sacrificed himself. And the motif of diastinine, of the diastinine mystery tradition, where dismemberment is an important part of the sacrificial theme. In the vision, the skinning, confined to the head, is symbolism for the incorporation of the life principle or soul. The life principle, for Zosimus, the decapitation signifies the obtaining of the arcane substance, and in Zosimus's dream, the meridian of the sun represents the arcane substance. The bowl is a wonder-working vessel in which immersion takes place and transformation into a spiritual being is effective. The vessel also represents a uterus of spiritual renewal or rebirth. And the water in alchemy has a relation to spirit, a fact that may be explained simply by the nature of the oldest form of chemistry, the art of cooking. The steam arising from boiling water conveys the first impression of transformation of the corporeal into the spirit or pneuma. In fact, water and spirit are often identical. The ancient alchemical idea of the dragon that bites its own tail and then slays itself, weds itself, and impregnates itself dramatically reappears in Zosimus' vision. The priest Eon submits himself to an unendurable torment. The sacrificer performs the act of the sacrifice by piercing Eon through with a sword. Eon then foreshadows the white-clad figure, the meridian of the sun, who is decapitated. This symbolizes the sun or gold which is to be sacrificed, and his head is struck off, for this contains the arcanium, the head of a man signifies the seat of consciousness.
I'm going to speak on the remaining passages. Jung says at one point that the symbolism, you know, why are we interested in this vision at this point in time, meaning the early 20th century, when our scientific knowledge is decidedly more advanced? And the interest comes because the symbolism, the interest for him, and he presumes therefore for us, his readers, comes because the symbolism of alchemy gives us great insight into the structure of the unconscious. And he is talking here about an obviously tortured process that, as I see, is based on two, you might call them presuppositions or principles, as you please. The first is that man is a microcosm of the universe and of God, that being the macrocosm. The tortured process that is being spoken of in this instance is rejoining the macrocosm, going back to God. The second guiding, organizing principle for Jung and for us would be the idea of Zosimus' vision incorporating the idea of projections, and this relates to the idea of vestiges in the unconscious from an earlier conscious state within the human kingdom. And projection would be the idea of personifying, giving personal symbols and meanings and qualities to objects that would normally be considered inert or without such qualities or capabilities. Carol and Jerry have spoken at length on many of these personifications that are present in the vision. So what Zosimus is doing, according to Jung, as I see it, and I would welcome comment on this, is given his state of knowledge and understanding of both science and religion, which would be one and the same to him, he is projecting qualities and features that he feels are necessary to understand what he perceives as a very tortured process of rejoining the greater cosmos. I would just like to point out a couple of projections, a couple of things that are pretty, well, actually interlace and run through the whole vision and the whole commentary. The first is the idea of the water, which would be the elixir. It is, from my reading, and I stress that, from my reading, I would welcome comment on this, the only fluid feature, the only fluid, the only fluid present in this process. Thus, it can go everywhere, it can be everything, it can be spirit, it can infiltrate matter, it is the only interactive element or integrative, excuse me, it is the only integrative element as such. It is spirit, it is matter, it, at one point it is stated that it kills and it vivifies. Perhaps by contrast, I'd like to read a couple of passages from the Taoist Tao Te Ching. This is the copy I have. And it is translated from the Chinese by Chu Da Cao, I guess, with all due respect. In chapter 8, it begins, and these are simply selected passages. The highest goodness is like water. Water is beneficent to all things, but does not contend. And chapter 38, the superior benevolence acts without a motive. I really would welcome Roger's comment on this, but I am drawing the conclusion that at least in this very limited reading of a Taoist presentation, we see water as the fluid element, the elixir, who goes everywhere without contention, without judgment, and it simply is. I infer from the way water is described throughout Zosimos and throughout Jung a more Western orientation that although water would serve the same function, it can go everywhere. It is the only integrative element. It is fluid. There is an element of judgment involved in the Western interpretation of this same function that water serves. Now, a lot of these, this may be an appropriate point to point out, and Jung makes great efforts to point this out, particularly with regard to the next symbol, the stone or the lapis, that a lot of these symbols that come from Zosimos are really quite cross-cultural. I've just spoken of water and the differences I perceive in how an Eastern philosophy views that symbol versus the Western philosophy. The other symbol is the idea of the stone or the lapis. And this is something that was quite astonishing to me. But according to Jung, the qualities of the Christ, and Zosimos was a Christian, were seen as his time, at least, and perhaps this is still present with us, as being quite remote from the average man. So you had this belief in man being a microcosm who could with great difficulty rejoin his creator. There was great attention paid to the Christ figure who was seen as remote. Therefore, how did man, if you will, ground these qualities, since he indeed was a microcosm, in himself? And it appears the answer was in the idea of a stone. And this is a very cross-cultural symbol that even applies to less advanced non-Christian cultures. The idea being that all the elements, including the minerals from the mineral kingdom, are here, you know, within you, the individual. And an element apparently of the Catholic Mass is the division of the elements into the four parts. We get into the basic quaternary here, and this is embodied in the stone, which grounds a man, gives him his basic four qualities upon which he can build his righteousness and his ascent, as I understand it. But the stone is often equated with permanence, divinity, triunity, the self. As such, the stone, now if we look at the symbolism, the stone then is not integrative, it can be subdivided, and it is not fluid. This is the thing that is most striking to me. One comment I will make is what I get out of this particular alchemical study is a very good overview of an entire process, but it does not give us what we're getting here today, which, and I'll use perhaps an inappropriate term, gives us the technology of how this process takes place within ourselves and how we manifest it outward and interact with the universe, which starts really down here with our commingling with the air that surrounds us. We have an overview here of a very, I'll use the word again, tortured process of overcoming one's individuation, in Jungian terms, and that's it. We don't really understand, or at least I certainly didn't, how this process itself takes place, which is what I feel we're getting here. The other thing I just like to say, I'll revert to my previous comments about this being based on the view of man as microcosm versus the universe as macrocosm. I was interested when I read this book, Serpents in the Sky, which is not too watered down, but a nice concise statement of the high wisdom of ancient Egypt. And John Anthony West speaks about, you wouldn't call it a conflicting view, but you would call it perhaps a slightly different view. Schwaller de Lubitz, who is not the writer here, but to whom the writer, John Anthony West, is referring, calls the Egyptian philosophy the anthropocosm, the man cosmos, a concept whose subtleties are not easily grasped. Believing that, let's go on to take a shot at it. It is easier to say what the anthropocosm is not than to say what it is. Taoism and Zen take negative explanation as the safest way out and leave it at that. But the rational Western mind does not take readily to this kind of approach, and Schwaller de Lubitz takes pains to deal with the concept of the anthropocosm as well as language will allow. Actually, the anthropocosm may be found underlying all initiatic philosophies, but differently expressed in different philosophy. Man is now, here we're getting to the heart of the matter, man is not a product of the universe, nor a scale model of it. He is to be regarded as an embodiment, an embodiment, its essence, incarnated in physical form. If an artist succeeds in putting all that he knows, feels, believes, and understands into a work of art, that work is not a scale model of the artist, yet it is more than a product. It is not to be understood as distinct from the artist, as a child from its mother, yet it is not identical to him either. It is an embodiment of the artist, an artistic expression of all that he is. The anthropocosm bears an analogical relationship to the universe that created man. I will end on that note simply pointing out that this might be, as I said before, another view of the universe and its relation to man, and man and his relation to the universe, than that underlying the vision written of in this alchemical study.
Thank you all. Thank you. See you next week.
Yeah, thank you.